You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hey, welcome back to episode 21 of the Untaming podcast. Today's guest is Gail Tully, the founder of Spinning Babies. She was so lovely to chat with, so I'm sure you'll enjoy this one, even if you're not someone who is or intends to become pregnant. There is a large element of natural movement involved in spinning babies. I hope you liked the last episode with Nadine Artemis on successful self-dentistry. Please let me know if you have any follow-up questions. I'd be happy to help you find the answers. Here is a message from our sponsor. The next episode to air on the 23rd of August is with Dr. Marie-Claire Arrieta, a microbiologist and co-author of a book titled Let Them Eat Dirt. But for now, here is Gail Tully. Sixty-year-old Gail Tully was born in Texas and grew up in Minnesota. She currently lives in Minneapolis with her husband, Vic. Together, they have six children and seven grandchildren. Gail is the creator of Spinning Babies, a childbirth approach focusing on baby's position and rotation in the birth process. Gail is a published author and midwife who trains nurses, midwives, doulas, and childbirth educators in a new birth paradigm. Spinning Babies has been online since 2002, providing free information for parents and providers at spinningbabies.com. Last night, she had her typical 6 hours of sleep, and for lunch today, she had a sandwich, which is not typical for her, on gluten-free bread. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Emily. How are you?
Very good, thank you. So whenever I hear that someone I know is pregnant, my first instinct is to respond with, oh, you simply have to read these 10 books and watch these videos and this documentary and listen to all these podcasts. But with, you know, with some self-restraint to avoid coming across too eager, I tell myself, you know, everyone knows how obsessed you are with birth. They'll come to you if they're looking for something. Just pick one thing to recommend to them. And so my one go-to recommendation is to suggest they check out the Spinning Babies website.
Emily, that's so wonderful to hear that. Mm. That's an honor to hear that. I think that's because Spinning Babies is different. It unites two opposites that we have in our birth world today. One is the natural birth movement, which is reminding everyone that we have physiology that knows how to give birth. Mm-hmm. And one is the, you know, the extreme technological point of view that rescues people when the physiological birth doesn't work. So people in those groupings, I guess you could say, see things over and over again that supports their point of view. But, you know, sometimes what we don't see when we have a point of view to support is the birds that aren't following into our belief system. So the technological person doesn't see the beautiful spontaneous birds, and the person that promotes physiological birth sometimes doesn't understand the path a parent has to go through when they need the technology. And Spinning Babies is a third point of view, like a bridge between the two, because we bring out birth anatomy in a new way. Mm. We bring an awareness of birth in a way that empowers the parents and the providers in both extreme experiences or in both sides of the spectrum. It's more of a full spectrum, looking at a wholeness.
Yeah.
And yet we don't look at birth the way either group sees it. We're not simply about just letting time take care of birth.
Yeah. I really do rave about it when I share it with people, because I mean, I began doing spitting babies exercise early in my first pregnancy and then continued them on after he was born and then through my second pregnancy. And I still do them today, like going on 5 years, just because I find wow. that they're so good for you just to stay, to keep those sort of natural movements into your life on a regular basis.
That's beautiful. You're hearing Emily talk about keeping her full range of motion. We have activities on our website and we have daily essentials video that takes just a half an hour session on helping muscles above the uterus, below the uterus, to the sides, front and back. The whole body is actually determining the space that baby has to be in the ideal position. And we need that range of motion whether we're pregnant or not, evidently.
Yeah. Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here. For the listener who's never heard of it, can you tell us about spitting babies?
Spitting babies, like you said, it's an approach, it's a perspective or paradigm to look at birth in a new way. And babies rotate through the pelvis, facing a hip, but sometimes front or back, when they're above the pelvis. But then coming into the pelvis deeper, they go from facing a hip and then halfway through the pelvis turn about 45 degrees. And then to come out the bottom of the pelvis, finish turning 90 degrees to face the back. And that's because at different levels of the pelvis, there's different space available. And the baby turns the dome of their head into an angle or a diameter of the pelvis that has the roomiest space. But now we're just talking about the bony pelvis. The bony pelvis is lined with muscles and ligaments and a connective tissue called fascia that links together our bones and muscles and ligaments, our organs. Everything is held together with the beautiful webbing of a very fluid and mobile fascia. However, sometimes it's not so fluid and mobile, and so our movements can help it become so again. Our stretches and jiggles can help mobilize our bodies so our baby slips out the pelvis rather than get stuck in a bone or a muscle for hours or sometimes days, Emily. Sometimes those long labors are days, and people's only response is some labors are like this, or your baby might be in a challenging position. In other words, the head isn't lined up with the bony pelvis. And spinning babies talks about preparation for birth, comfort in pregnancy, ease in childbirth. And we do it by helping the baby's rotation be easier. And that's why we call it spinning babies. It's just a cute little way of referring to fetal rotation.
Yeah, so you've mentioned fascia.
I knew
I was going to stumble over this word.
Fascia.
Yeah. Could you talk about it a bit more? They're very tiny, right? Like almost minuscule.
But the little fibrils can be. You know, fascia comes in sheaths, comes in ligaments like ropes, it's the tendons, it's everything under our skin into our bones, between our bone marrow and our skin cells. So it can look like webbing, it can look like membranes. If a meat eater is preparing a chicken and they take that white membrane off the leg muscle of the chicken, for instance, or has a steak and they see that white marbling in the muscle, that's fascia. We talk about our muscles linking our skeleton together, but really it's the fascia. And in the last few years, we've had much more attention put on the fascia. The doctors are starting to see the importance of not, you know, just cutting away the fascia and either throwing it away or not sewing it back together. If we don't move in certain directions, our fascia gets stiff and can even get sort of fibrous or thicker. Ligaments with fascia there's for the uterus, you know, the uterus grows in pregnancy. So the fascia needs to grow along with it. And it does that by having little muscle fibers embedded in the ligaments, like the round ligament. And the round ligament is two supporting ropes, so to speak, anchoring ropes to the uterus. If you think of the uterus like a hot air balloon, the two ropes come down, drape over the pubic bone, and end up around the labia. And they, right above the pubic bone, in the area that somebody might put their hand under the pregnant belly, on the pregnant belly, it can sometimes hurt there when someone rolls over at night or stands up fast or something. They can get a spasm in the round ligament that is a muscle spasm, but it's wrapped up in fascia. And we can do some activities to, you know, breathe it out, hold it, support it, breathe it out for the immediate, and then also do some very gentle stretching. And I'm talking about super gentle and not very far stretching with the round ligament. Very subtle, but it can release the spasm and bring comfort in about 2.5 minutes. It takes about 2.5 minutes. And the pregnant person themselves can just lay back, bend their knees, prop themselves up on a pillow, and get their finger around that little rope that hurts. Now, if it doesn't hurt, you don't have this problem. If it hurts, you know where to find it. That's a little bit technical. Most of our techniques are super easy.
Yeah.
You know, we have things that are just the stretching exercises for pregnancy, kind of yoga-like. And then we have special restorative techniques that restore the fascia to balance, restore the muscles to balance. What we mean by balance, Emily, is not too tight, not too loose, and not too twisty. Hmm. We don't have to be perfect. We're just lining up the uterus with our pelvis. We're taking out a spasmy muscle, a pain in the buttocks, a pain down the leg, a pain in the front. These are things that people can work on in pregnancy that bring comfort in pregnancy, but are going to make the birth go easier too.
Yeah. So there's a lot of misinformation out there that says you can just keep eating what you want and moving however you want during pregnancy. Can we talk about some of the common lifestyle habits that are altering our bodies, like most specifically affecting our pregnant, laboring, birthing bodies?
Oh, thank you for asking, Emily. As a midwife, I'm quite interested in nutrition and movement. Mm. You know, it's interesting too. Why do we want to, you know, eat the things that we know aren't really the best to grow a baby? It's really a lot of it has to do with advertising and the tastiness of sugar,
yeah.
Right? And oil, the perfect blend of sugar, oil, and salt. Now, a little salt is important for a pregnant body.
Yeah.
It helps balance the fluids. It's actually good to have salt to taste, which means if you're in the mood for something salty, have a little bit of salty. Just don't have a whole bag of potato chips. Mm. If we focus on vegetables and fruits, and mostly vegetables, maybe just a little fruit, and make sure that we're getting plenty of servings of vegetables close to nature as possible, and proteins, 4 to 6 protein servings a day.
Yeah.
That's really important because your liver and kidneys are working very hard to grow a baby. They need extra protein. You're growing blood. If the blood is growing in middle of pregnancy, we're going to see it at first by a drop in the hemoglobin. So when that mid-pregnancy blood check is seeing how your iron's doing, we expect good calorie intake and a drop of hemoglobin. If we have those two together, we say, okay, the plasma's growing. The red blood cells will pick up later. But we have to make sure we're getting good quality calories and good calorie intake to grow our blood. Then at the end of pregnancy, we have an iron that's back up around 12 hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. And then the movement, you know, so I just wanted to catch that. Eat what we want, because I don't want people to feel deprived. Mm. The pregnancy diet's very nurturing. You get root vegetables and you're getting enough protein. Yes, it's good to cut down on grains and sugars, not absolutely necessarily. Like if it's better not to go around in a sense of deprivation, but maybe say, okay, I'm going to have my ice cream on Friday night, my pizza and ice cream on Friday night, and the rest of the week, get my green vegetables and my cabbage and, you know, sweet potato, et cetera, et cetera. What I find is if we get enough protein, we don't have to go crazy for the protein, but we really need to eat more protein than a non-pregnant person, an extra serving, 80 to 100 grams, and with twins, 120 grams. Mm. I really find that reduces high blood pressure. So thanks for letting me go on a tangent about that.
No, that's great.
Because it's fantastic to prevent high blood pressure, and you have to be disciplined with it for it to work. It'll work for the day that you eat the protein, and the next day you say, well, my blood pressure's down, I won't do it today, and your blood pressure will go back up in that case for the person that has a tendency there.
Mm. And what about lifestyle habits for the way we move?
Yeah, again, you know, it's like finding new ways to move in different directions. We walk forward so much. We sit with our knees forward. We sit still, and we want a little bit of motion in our ocean. We want a little bit of fluidity to our spine. So a birth ball, an exercise ball that's pumped up firmly, so we have to sit on it like a tripod, is great. Or at least sitting on a little, sometimes there's physio discs people can sit on. We're not talking about sitting on a ring toy, a donut-shaped swim ring. That would not be good because it's not good for circulation to the perineum. But to sit maybe on something that has a little bit of lift for the pelvic floor, and that we want our sits bones firmly on the chair, you know, or on, that's why we want an exercise ball pumped up. We want some firmness, but we want mobility. So our typical furniture is not great. Sitting back all slumped up with a curve in our spine is not great because it reduces the function of our spine, which then in turn reduces function of our organs and, you know, including the metabolism that supports a good fetal position.
So you're talking about sitting in like a reclined position, right?
Yeah, like we would sit on the couch and get all cozy with a book or a movie, you know. So maybe it's better to lay on our side on the couch or get a pillow for our knees and a birth ball in front of us and even a pillow on the birth ball and watch TV that way. Turn to the side, watch TV from the side. Try a variety of positions. Sit backwards on a chair. So you can lean forward then, relax, but you're up on your tuberosities with your belly like a hammock. To receive the baby's back in the front.
I even think of things that they probably don't come up quite as often, but like sitting in a car when you're driving or even going to the toilet, like using a toilet is not quite as natural as how we evolved to just squat outside.
Oh, I so agree, Emily. I always say at my workshops, if anybody's interested in a distribution of the sort of ceramic toilets that are in the floor. You'll see them if you go to some rural places in Okinawa or Japan. I remember them from France when I was a toddler. My mother was trying to get me to go to the bathroom in an open pit, you know, in the shopping center. It was in the shopping center where women were buying dresses. And, you know, for an adult, it wasn't very far apart to put their legs, but for a two-year-old, it was tremendous stride, and I wasn't going to do it. It was a big black hole down there. But, you know, the Japanese toilets are very nice ceramic, and you just squat over them. They come with plumbing, and if anybody wants to be a distributor, I'll give you a year of free advertising on spinning babies, because I'd like to bring them back. And bring them around the world.
Yeah.
I think that it helps the health quite a bit. But people here are very fond of something called a squatty potty, or just putting a stool in front of the toilet so that both feet are propped up. And that changes the angle of the anus through the pelvic floor and into the toilet so that your body doesn't have to try to figure out how to eliminate through a kink in the hose. you think of, why does a toddler hide behind the chair and poop in their diaper when their parents are trying to get them to go potty on a little potty chair? They'll give them Cheerios and then they'll resort to chocolates, you know. and the child doesn't want to sit and poop on the toilet because inside their body they're kinking off their, you know, their rectum.
Yeah.
And it's hard to go to the bathroom. It encourages constipation and other digestive problems. Instead they go around behind a piece of furniture thinking the parents can't track them. And they squat and fill their diaper there. And an adult should be doing something similar, but maybe not behind the living room chair.
I like your recommendation of the squatty potty. I wish I'd known about it in my second pregnancy. I was just climbing up onto the toilet so I could stand on it to go to the toilet.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, you have to have a sturdy seat, or just put the seat up.
Yeah.
So people make it like a ring shaped stool that matches their toilet, mm-hmm. makes a ring around it like a little porch about halfway down, and then they can put their feet there.
Nice. So yeah. Nowadays pregnant women are taught to do regular Kegel exercise and squats to prepare them for birth. How effective are they?
Well, they help one thing and not the other, right? And the thing that is so good to know about muscles is muscles never come alone. Muscles always have a partner, an agonist and an antagonist, it's called. So you have one set of muscles is supporting something that another set of muscles needs to collaboratively support. And if you develop one set, the other set will be neglected and it causes imbalance. So there was a lot of criticism about Kegeling for a while back. And the good reason for the criticism is that Kegels were over-recommended. I heard people being told, do 500 a day to stop wetting your pants. And what? Now think about it. You've got this figure eight muscle. You know, it goes around the vagina and the urethra in one of the loops of the figure eight, goes around the anus in the other loop. So you're trying to tighten up the front loop to stop the flow of urine. That's a Kegel. Okay, that's what we're talking about. You're doing a Kegel if you're peeing and you stop peeing before your bladder's empty. That's a Kegel. So if you're tightening that 500 times a day, 100 times a day, that muscle's getting short and short and short. And now you've done something like had black tea or sugar, and your bladder's a little irritated, maybe dairy, sugar, black tea, coffee. It's irritated your bladder. You're about to pee your pants. Or you got a pregnant belly above your bladder and you're about to pee your pants. You try to Kegel, and the muscles can't stop the flow of urine. Why? Because they're already short. They've already been shortened up by 100 Kegels a day or more. So their collaborative team has not been attended to. They're weak. The Kegels are strong. It's okay to do Kegels, to do 25 a day. Mm. Great. No problem. But don't neglect their partners. So to get their partner, you get a small child's ball, I would say 9 inches. How many centimeters is that? 22 centimeters?
I think
something
so.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a soft ball like that. It might be inflatable. Mm-hmm. You sit fair and square in your chair so your feet are flat on the floor and your knees are bent and comfortable. And you put the ball in between your knees. Now, if you don't have a ball, you could take a pillow and scrunch a pillow between your knees. Your knees are close enough to hold that there without falling to the floor. And as you exhale, you squeeze that ball. Not like an athlete, you know, not like you're trying to break a walnut, but you squeeze so you feel the engagement of the muscles in your legs. When you inhale, you relax your knees. When you exhale, you squeeze your knees. Do about 5 of those for each meal of the day. It's going to encourage you to sit down to eat at some point, which that's hard for an active mother, isn't it?
Mm.
And so I call that the knee squeeze. Now you do 5 of those between the knee, and then you take the same ball or pillow and put it up between your thighs. For people with short legs, it's going to look like the ball only moves over an inch. For people with long legs, it's going to be about 4 inches. And you squeeze again 5 times, squeeze with the exhale. Not as hard as you can, but so that you feel your muscles engage. Do that once for each meal of the day or 3 times a day for several days in a row, and you're going to stop wetting your pants. It activates the neurophysiological communication between the leg muscles and the pelvis. It wakes up the bladder. People are having surgery when really what they need is to activate their own electrical system within their neurology. It's not about building up strength. It's about getting our body working again.
Hmm. And what about squats or squatting?
So squatting, there's lots of ways to squat. Hmm. And squatting can be a good preparation. If you squat to go to the bathroom, truly squat to go to the bathroom, you can squat throughout pregnancy. But for most of us who grew up in school chairs and continue to work at a desk, who don't have a lot of motion, I would say skip squatting in the first trimester. It puts too much downward pressure on the uterus. Let the uterus grow up and out of the pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we have to assess how strong are your legs. And it doesn't really matter how old you are. I was a young mom and I couldn't squat at all. I had to go over to the wall, put my back on the wall and slide down the wall to about like a seated position, but there's no chair there.
Mm-hmm.
And after a minute of that, my leg muscles were burning and I had to stop. Well, turns out I was allergic to oats. After I gave up oats, my legs stopped burning. But,
oh, wow.
You know, this, yeah, interesting, huh?
Mm.
And so I'm building up a little bit of leg muscle like that way for a week or two. But, you know, in order to squat out in the middle of the floor, I need more than my thigh muscles. I need my calf muscles. I need some length in the fascia.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from the bottom of my foot, past my calf, around my knees, up the back of my thighs, and to my sits bones, those two bony parts you can reach if you're sitting to listen. You can reach around, find that little bony bone at the bottom of your buttocks. If a kid sits on your lap, you know, after a while you have to say, okay, get off my lap because your bony little butt's hurting my thigh. You know, those are the sits bones.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a line of fascia connected from the bottom of your feet all the way up to the sits bones. Then there's some special fascia called the sacrotuberous ligament connected from the sits bones to the sacrum. And if we can lengthen that portion of the fascia, that ligament, the sacrotuberous ligament, we can have a more free sacrum at birth. Pushing will be easier, but also our mental outlook is better when our sacrum is mobile. And I don't mean flopping around. I just mean responsive to body functions. So squatting is going to help our sacrum. And it's also has the potential to help our pelvic floor if we squat in such a way that gives the pelvic floor an opportunity to lengthen. I'm really interested in long, supple muscles rather than short, tight muscles. So a lot of Kegeling is shortening our pelvic floor. Fine, do 25 a day, something like that. But give it a balance by doing this particular type of squat.
Hmm.
So first of all, I said, what should we do before a squat? We should do calf stretches. We have some on our website. I refer people to Katie Bowman's Nutritious Movement website mm-hmm. for calf stretches. Let's do that for a couple of weeks. Now, second trimester, we could do calf stretches all the way through first trimester. Now, second trimester, we're ready for squats. if we just learn about squats, we can do some calf stretches first for a few days at least. And then now we're going to start some squats out in the middle of the room. We could hang on to doorknobs of a heavy door. We could hang on to a big bedpost, some kind of a pole to give us a counterbalance, or we could hang on to a friend or partner. Then we're not going to try to squat deep. We're going to try to squat with our tailbone flaring out behind us. So here's how we do it. We have our feet point, our toes pointing forward, and our knees over our ankles. We act like we're going to sit on a chair very far behind us, just out of reach. So we flip our butt to try to catch that chair, right? We're doing an anterior pelvic tilt while we squat. And we just come down low enough to keep that anterior pelvic tilt without losing it. So maybe we're only squatting as low as a chair. Emily, we're not trying to squat and show off how low we can squat. If we're cooking our vegetables, going to the bathroom and everything in a full squat, fine. Keep it up and ignore this part of the podcast. But if you're learning how to squat, the type of squat we want is if you've ever squatted out in the woods when you're camping or in an alley when you're trying to find your car after a rock concert in here or something like that. You squat such a way that you flip your pelvis so you don't pee on your shoes. Mm-hmm. If you can, if you're squatting to pee and you're able to do it so you avoid your shoes, that's kind, not by putting your feet wide apart, but by flipping your pelvis. And most women get what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They feel that muscle memory. And we want to do a few of those. I'm really good for, like, in general, let's do 5 a day, you know? So, like with the ball squeeze, I say do 5 between the knee, 5 between the thigh, mm-hmm. 3 times a day, because I'm trying to help that person who isn't activated in their muscles yet. But once you're good to go, you could probably do it just 5 times a day.
Yeah.
We have a technique favorite called the windmill. It's a common technique in prenatal yoga or even in any exercise class. The windmill, when it's done with the legs apart, is really great for sciatica. You can go to the Spinning Babies website, look under pregnancy, and look under daily activities, and you'll see a free list of things to do each day. You could, you know, pick 6 of them, pick 10 of them, switch it up, do certain set one day and do another set another day. If you want more guidance, then you might want the downloaded video, Daily Essentials, and you'll get more guidance from Sarah Longacre of Bluma Yoga, bluma.com yoga, who did that video. She was the motive behind that video, and she's the pregnant person in the video. Hmm. She's a very active yoga instructor and teacher of a yoga instructor.
Yeah. Hmm. What about posture?
Yeah, so alignment, alignment with the earth. You know, it's we want posture for function. In the birth world, maternal positioning means how are we positioned when we sit or lay down, give birth, or just in pregnancy. That's called maternal positioning. And Jean Sutton of New Zealand, a wonderful midwife, has written Optimal Fetal Positioning, and she focuses on maternal positioning to help the belly be a hammock. And when her book came out in the 1990s, I found it a couple of years later, and I was delighted. And I was recommending this approach of posture for good fetal positioning to the pregnant women that were in my care. And it was working. In a couple of weeks of having good posture, their babies would be curled up in an ideal position coming down from the left side of their bodies. The left side of the body has the anatomy that lets the baby curl up so its chin is on its chest, aiming the dome of the head into the pelvis. This helps them spin through the pelvis much easier. And Jean Sutton's book, optimal fetal positioning. It's very famous to this day. But if you have somebody who now things seem to have changed a bit, what's changed in our society? We have much more sitting. We have much more metabolic issues like obesity, low thyroid. Even for people who are not obese, low thyroid's a real issue and is indicated in fetal malpositions. More babies are breech or posterior, which is sunny side up, for women with low thyroid function. And this shows that fetal position is a reflection of metabolism. And I say in spinning babies, fetal position is a reflection of the space available. And alignment and function creates the space available. So it's all connected. It's a holistic approach. We can't say, what is the one thing that's going to take care of it all?
Yeah.
And that was easier in the 1990s. And what I found, you know, 10 years after Gene Sutton's book came out, is we were having an epidemic of low thyroid. And body work became more important to help restore the balance and restore the function of the body. It leads us to good nutrition as well. And we know that movement, now we have scientific evidence that movement is as important or more important than nutrition. Now, I would have a hard time giving up the importance of nutrition, because I see wonderful things with healthy pregnancies and good recovery afterwards if people would just get off the white sugar and white flour and get to living vegetables to eat, you know, and I'm a meat eater. I'm not opposed to meat eating, but healthier choices.
Yeah,
for sure.
Okay. This next question, what effect does sex have on the pregnant body and the pelvic floor?
What did you say? Sex?
Yeah.
Are we talking sex?
Yes.
Let's talk about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm gonna turn that question around and say the experience of sex, a person's, especially a female person's experience of sex, can be an indication of the comfort of their pelvic floor. And the comfort or the alignment of their pelvic floor can be an indication for fetal positioning and ease in birth. So we live in a society that can be quite offensive to the pelvic floor,
mm-hmm.
clenching, defending ourselves, sitting too much, not being too inactive, and also over-exercising our pelvic floor. You know, 100 Kegels a day so that we can keep that jade egg in, you know, no matter what size it is, ostrich egg, you know. And so we can create spasm or short muscles in the pelvic floor that then the uterus is trying to help the baby slip out, but the baby's head comes on a tight pelvic floor. And now there's tremendous pain sometimes. And if there's also a twist, oh man, that baby can't get through there. Epidural comes along, it might soften the pelvic floor. We have some techniques that can help lengthen and soften the pelvic floor temporarily that were developed by Dr. Carol Phillips. The sideline release is excellent.
Mm.
Now, this is also excellent for more comfortable sex if somebody is having pelvic pain and it's showing up with pain and sex. So pain and sex, pelvic pain are all indications that we need more body balancing. Now, people say, oh, the baby's not aware of sex. Well, I had a little friend that told me different. When I was in a mother's group, one of the mothers was talking to the three-year-olds. You know, three-year-olds often remember their births, and they're just talking enough to be able to say something about their birth that shows that they do remember. And they remember before they're three, but they often don't have the language to talk about it. And this little three-year-old boy was gestating a long time in the womb. And it was like getting to be time where his parents were like, he's got to get born. You know, what can we do to help him get born? How can we get labor going? And of course, sex is recommended as one of those ways. And it's been shown to be useful if someone's sexual throughout their pregnancy, then they're used to that juicy oxytocin release from making love. And it does have a beneficial effect on starting labor. And her little boy looked up at her when she said, "Do you remember the day you were born?" And he looked up at her and said, "Bang, bang on the head, bang, bang." So yes, he had a very visceral memory of that night. He was born shortly after. He got the knock on the door that his evacuation was called for.
Yeah, time to go.
But I think that, you know, the little being inside is kind of coming from a cosmic consciousness and then moving towards a child's consciousness. So I think sex and pregnancy and birth can be lovemaking. You know, hopefully it is lovemaking, stress relieving. There's a lot of flow and beauty in the sexual relationship when it's honoring and respectful. Mm. Masturbation's being listed as one of the comfort measures in labor. So if that person that's giving birth finds that very comforting to them, they may find that to be beneficial. The person that's not comfortable with that, or that's not their go-to, for instance, then, you know, let's find something else for them. But does that answer your question? Is that where we were? Are you talking about sex positions and bait?
No, help? You answered the question. That was great. Thank you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, as we're learning all of this from you, I'm sure some listeners are wondering, but pregnant people frequently complain about various aches and discomforts.
Yeah.
Is that normal?
It normal mathematically, yes.
Yeah.
Is it inevitable? No.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, when we talk about the design of birth, whether you like to think of it as a divine design, the design of evolution, neither would put us to the point where reproduction would be so painful that we can't sleep or walk. Hmm. You know, that's not going to be an evolutionary advantage. And I think if you like to think about it as divine design, I like to think about abundance and love rather than punishment. I don't go that direction. And so, yeah, plus, Emily, just my lived experience is by adding body balancing, by aligning the pelvis, releasing muscles that are too tight, supporting things that can get loose, like a belly that hangs over, and taking a twist out. People don't understand that the uterus can get twisted. Only the doctors that run into it and see it with their own eyes, they get it. You can find it in the literature. But what I experienced is that when babies can't get their head down, and we do a technique that untwists the uterus, then the baby goes head down. It adds comfort. A baby that's not in a good position is not necessarily uncomfortable, but the pelvis might be uncomfortable. Other people have no discomfort whatsoever because they're so tight. And then once they're in labor, it shows up. So, yeah, that we don't have to accept that kind of pain or discomfort. We can start learning about our bodies and finding symmetrical ways to rest and restorative techniques to restore comfort to the body. It can happen in 15 minutes and 2 hours, 30 minutes a day to sustain it, you know, and little subtle lifestyle changes, like not crossing our legs or throwing our leg out of the car, one leg out of the car when we stand up to get out of the car, because that is a trigger for sciatica. But keep our feet together, knees together, and learn how to move in and out of chairs as if you're a mermaid. Not that a mermaid would sit in a chair, but or drive a car, but it helps you to kind of like really seriously think about moving your legs together to swivel out of the car and rise up so that you're not setting off sciatica. I'm just chatting away here, Emily. I'll try to pause frequently so you can direct the conversation.
No, I'm loving this. I like where you're going with the answers. So I think of what you said before about lying in like a reclined position in the compression of organs. So that would be an example, I guess, of like our poor lifestyle habits causing these aches and discomforts.
It takes about 2 weeks to get past an achy back for sitting up. You get tired. Mm-hmm. So sit up for a while over the tuberosities. Sit on a chair, lean forward when you get tired. Lay on your side when you get tired. But try to reduce the slouching back to short periods of the day, much shorter periods of the day than typically what's socially encouraged.
Yeah. And you also mentioned before about the baby being on your left side because there's more space. So is there any truth to lying on your left side more than your right to help use gravity?
Well, see, people think that the uterus is a water balloon.
Yeah.
And if I lay on my left side, my baby will fall to the left. Mm-hmm. And if I lay on my right, oops, the baby will fall on my right. And the reason we don't slouch back is because the baby will turn sunny side up. This is the mind trying to simplify anatomy or simplify the lesson.
Yeah.
And, you know, it came out of optimal fetal positioning, but it's not what Jean Sutton said in optimal fetal position. You have to read the whole book. People want to reinterpret in just a simple sentence. And even doctors and midwives don't understand that the uterus is not a water balloon. The reason the baby comes down from the left easier through the pelvis in general, especially with a first baby or two, is because of the shape of the uterus is more curved on that side for most people, not for 100% of people, but for most people. And the uterus is steeper on the right. Now, and so their back is steeper, which puts the top of their head down. If they're right, if the back of their head is towards the right hip and they're facing the left hip, they might take a longer labor. If the back of the head is on the left and their chin is tucked, that labor is going to go more straightforward. Even if they're sunny side up from the left, they can have a shorter labor than if they're facing the back with their spine to the front, but they're way over on the right. Hmm. Right occiput anterior. It's more about chin tucking, but chin tucking babies wasn't very attractive. Spinning babies gets better attention. But chin tucking babies, chin tucked babies have an easier birth than babies who's sending the top of their head in. So we have to be careful. And then the difference between spinning babies and optimal fetal positioning is understanding the birth anatomy to the depth, restoring the balance of the baby, and then studying out the three levels of the pelvis. Mm-hmm. It's an approach of physiology that's parent-centered rather than provider-centered. The parents are empowered to take birth and birth preparation into their own hands, into their own bodies, really. So laying on the left side has benefits for other reasons. Studies in New Zealand show that babies do better if their mothers fall asleep on the left side or wake up on the left side compared to mothers who never sleep on their left side at all. Mm. And so I think with a body balancing, you're more comfortable changing sides, sleeping on both sides. Of course, you can only sleep on your left side so long and you got to roll over.
Yeah.
Heaven's sake, so not be crazy about trying to stay off our right side. Let's just have enough comfort in our pelvis and our shoulders so that we can change sides and sleep well.
Mm. So what is belly mapping and how do we do it?
You know, when I was creating Spinning Babies and talking to parents and doulas about fetal positioning, the first question, of course, when somebody finds out birth can be easier if the baby's starting out with labor on the left, you know, from the mother's lap. So the next question is, well, how do I tell my baby's position? And because I was also a doula trainer, I had to figure out a way that parents and doulas could talk to each other and the parent themselves could figure it out. The doula could ask the questions and help one question lead to the next to play a game of clues. Belly mapping is a game of clues. It's a three-step process that I developed in 2003 to teach parents and doulas the questions to ask where, you know, of course, where's your baby moving? But then to analyze, okay, where are the kicks? Where are the little fluttery wiggles down by the bladder? Are there any there or they're absent? Are there kicks to the right, to the left, or both the right and the left? And we follow the clues. They're listed out in our Spinning Babies website. You can go to Belly Mapping, our Spinning Babies website, and learn the process there. And we have a book. I'm hoping to turn it into a download. Right now it's a paper book to teach parents how to do this. We have an ebook for parents who are pregnant with breech babies, and it talks about breech belly mapping. And the wonderful side effect of playing this game with your baby to discover their kicks and wiggles is the immense strengthening of the relationship between the pregnant parents and the baby inside. And they can play tapping games and they can learn about each other's rhythms and voices. And it's beautiful to pace with your baby. They live at a slower pace than we do out here in society. And it's good to slow down. So belly mapping, you know, you lay down, you feel your contours of your baby and figure out what quadrants of the belly the baby has which body part in. And I just make it simple. I come from a Montessori background. And one of the beautiful things about Montessori is it helps a child who has all the stimulus in their environment slow it down, pick out a couple of things to focus on, and then engage at that level and then move out into the many clues, the many kicks and wiggles in this case. So that people, I think pregnant people can figure out their baby's position 80% of the time, you know, if there's not a placenta blocking the baby. If there's a placenta that's covering up the baby, you know, the baby finds it an enjoyable teddy bear, but the parents can't feel the baby on through the thickness of the placenta.
Yeah.
But you do it, you know, you can do it for a few minutes every night so that you get to learn about your baby as your baby grows. And it's much more doable after 35 weeks than it is at before 32 weeks, for sure.
I'm just kind of, I don't even know how to phrase this question, but I guess I'm thinking that regardless of whether the baby is anterior, posterior, breech, I think spinning babies exercises are helping to balance your body to get them out in whatever position they are in. Is that right?
Well, that can be. And it can also give them the space to get into a head down position with their chin tucked. Mm-hmm. Babies will be in the best position they can given the space available. So if we make the space for them, gravity and the anatomy of the baby work together to put that baby in a good space. You know, their head is heavier than their butt.
Yeah.
So the head is going to go down. The womb is not a gravity-free environment. That's a myth. And the balanced womb, that's a typically normal-shaped womb. You know, there are exceptions of people. See, the womb got formed out of two tubes. And in the male, those tubes turn into vents, deferens. Mm-hmm. And in the female, they merge together and become the uterus and have the egg tubes, the fallopian tubes. And so some people, they only developed one tube. Now, if the baby happens to be head down when they're big, when they're very little, they'll stay head down in that single-sided, it's called the unicornate uterus. If there happened to be breech, that person's going to have a much more challenging time having that baby turn head down after 30 weeks or so. And typically we just start paying attention to the baby's position. I start paying attention at 30 weeks, unless I know that they have an unusual usual uterus, then we want to start really early. But the doctors start paying attention at 36 weeks. Do you know why that is, Emily?
No, please tell me.
Because they say it's because the baby could turn back.
Mm-hmm.
There's two things going on. If that tight muscle or twist is causing the baby not to be head down, and you try to push a baby past that, they have to be big enough to be, you know, you shove them past a tight muscle, then that tight muscle holds them down. Who wants to get ready for life that way?
Mm.
Let's take the spasm out of that muscle. Then the baby can turn themselves, or if the doctor is turning the baby, or the midwife, the baby doesn't have to get shoved past a tight pelvic floor. You know, it's not that they go through the pelvic floor yet, but the pelvic floor is connected to the fascia, up to the obturator internus, that it's then by fascia is connected up to the psoas, that gets connected up to the posterior muscles, up to the diaphragm. You know, we're all one big single container, in one way of saying that.
Hmm.
not just for our digestive organs, but also affecting our womb. So we're making room there, then the baby's going to be able to go down easier and stay head down. If they're pushing a baby on a tight muscle, or they're pushing a baby past something, forcing it in the external cephalic version, and something goes wrong, the baby at 36 weeks can breathe air, so they can do an emergency C-section and try to save the baby. Spinning babies is a physiological approach. Instead of provider-centered force, we're using body-centered physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the baby and the pregnant mother are together in one physiological unit at the time. They're breathing and moving together. So let's help the mother enter into balance, into parasympathetic, relaxed nervous system. Oh, that's where babies want to snuggle up head down, tuck their chin. Birth flows more easily. There's less panic. You know, there's more relaxation and breathing, more opening. There's more trust.
Hmm.
And trust is a physiological state that comes out of the body. You know, our thinking always feels safer and more trusting if our physiology is relaxed. Yeah?
Yeah.
If we're on alert, the story we tell ourselves is danger is there. You know, we're worried about technological interventions, or we're worried about what's going to happen to us. It's okay for pregnant people to worry. That's part of preparing for parenting. If I wasn't worried about anything, I'd forget to buy diapers. You know, so some of that is normal developmentally. But if it's affecting our sleep or our trust levels, we can add body balancing and get to a much more beautiful state in our lives.
I have some questions here that are based on my own personal births, but I think they'll also be quite relevant for the listeners. With my first birth, I was in the second stage of labor for 4.5 hours. That is, you know, actively pushing for 4.5 hours. Needless to say, I have a personal disdain for the two-hour limit in conventional birthing. These long pushing phases, especially in first births, often result in cesareans. As a midwife, is there something mothers can do when they're approaching this two-hour mark to fend off a C-section?
Mm. Well, it's always good to say, you know, in my birth situation, what are the current signs, the current vital signs for myself and my baby? Am I currently at risk, or is this a theoretical risk? And some people aren't very comfortable. Some parents aren't very comfortable with theoretical risks. And some parents are like, well, that risk is not happening to me. So you have to honor your own feeling about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then fortunately, the science is showing that the 2-hour limit is not real.
Yeah.
It's not, there's no timer on a placenta. There's no timer on second stage.
Yeah.
But very often what happens is where the baby's trying to navigate a twist, a tight ligament, or a bad birth position.
Mm-hmm.
And women are taught to be on their backs with their feet apart, hold their breath, and bear down. Mm-hmm. And knees apart actually closes some of the space to the baby. So if the baby's head is visible or almost visible, it's better to put knees together and feet apart rather than knees apart.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because you can feel your own sits bones. If you stand up and reach around behind you, bend your legs, reach behind you and see what happens to your sits bones when your knees are together, and then slowly open your knees. You know, you need a little balance. Hang on to the table. And yeah,
mm-hmm.
you see that people are taught to push in a position that opens the top of the pelvis. Once in a while, a baby is stuck at the top of the pelvis, but most of the time when we're pushing, the baby's deep in the pelvis. So we want to change the birth positions. We want to align the muscles. Then if we have a situation for long push, it might be the baby's arm is by the up by the face so that you're pushing out a head and an elbow or a head and a wrist.
Mm.
That's going to take longer for sure. You know, there are reasons that pushing can take longer. We want to change a lot of positions, make sure you're getting breath. And, you know, in 4.5 hours, you're pregnant, you need a snack.
Yeah.
Yeah, of some sort, you know. What would you say? What helped you in your pushing? What helped you?
I helped because I could feel that he was coming out just slowly. So I was like, I know he's coming out, but he's taking his time. It's my first birth.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And do you attribute something like contractions were not close together, or you had a super strong pelvic floor, or did he have a mark on his head that kind of showed you what angle he was in?
Yeah, no, he didn't have any of that. I did have contractions that were different. Like sometimes they were only 2 minutes apart. Sometimes they were like 7-8 minutes apart. It was like that the whole labor.
Okay, so if you put the minutes together all at like say 4 minutes apart, you could have maybe had a 2-hour pushing stage.
Yeah.
would that have been true?
Yeah, probably.
Because that's a thing too, you know. Mm. That's a thing too.
So, yeah, after that, those 4.5 hours of pushing with my son, I was pleasantly surprised that for my second birth, I only had about 10 minutes of active pushing. And so I've heard tales that every push you do in your first birth is one less you push you do in your next birth. Is there... Is there truth to that?
Well, there's a little bit of truth to that. I mean, and that's a cute way of saying it. The cute way I have of saying it is second babies are worth it.
All right. Yeah.
from a birthing point of view, second babies are worth it.
Mm.
Because and that's that because of the tone. I think it has to do with the tone of the muscles. The second pregnancy, most women, and this is not 100% true, but most women are at their ideal tone for birth.
Mm.
The third birth can be longer than the second birth. Not always true. If you've got a tucked chin with a second baby, don't expect everything to take as long as the first one. But if that chin is up, then that little hope is a little dashed, you know. But the good thing is the techniques that we're promoting to restore balance can be done. It might take a couple hours in a labor, but it might take 15 minutes. It just depends because there's a spectrum of ease across the board. You know, we don't know where somebody's starting. We don't know if the baby just has one muscle they're trying to navigate or if they have muscles and close bones that they have to get through.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Spinning babies is so popular because so many midwives around the world are able to do a technique that doesn't take very long and see a huge difference of ease in the labor.
Hmm.
Like we're talking about having a cesarean, we did the technique, oh, we have a baby in the bed. You know, that happens just enough to make spinning babies wildly popular. It doesn't happen for everybody, but enough for us to be worldwide and wildly popular.
Yeah. Okay, this is my last one about my own personal birth.
Okay. I love it.
An hour and a half before my daughter was born, she was in the left, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, occiput anterior. Is that right? Left occiput anterior?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she was in that position as she had been for the past week. And then half an hour before she was born, I felt a significant move. And it was half an hour before she was born. So I didn't we didn't check to see exactly what position she was in. I assume she had possibly changed to posterior.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, she's about to come out. So that's just how she's going to come out now. But it was still a huge surprise to me that she ended up coming out bum first. And I've often heard tales of babies changing position right up to the last minute. But from talking to midwives, while it's possible, it doesn't seem very common. And the question that comes to mind here is, it's actually based on a relative who was pregnant with twins but was told that the position they were in made it impossible for them to be born naturally. So they were born via a scheduled C-section. So while it's possible for babies to change right at the very end, how realistic is it that they may change from an impossible position to a possible position that late?
Mm. If we do, well, see, there's quite a difference between breech and, say, babies who are laying sideways.
Mm.
So for the relative, impossible is sideways.
Yeah.
The baby's head is in one side and the bum is on the opposite side. So the head might be left and the butt might be right, or the butt might be left and the head might be right.
Yeah.
That baby's not coming out through the pelvis.
Mm.
Unless we do something. Now, babies lay sideways because the uterus is twisted. I'm convinced of it. There's no, even if there's a placenta in the way, but if there's a placenta in the way, it's also a need for a cesarean section. And thank goodness we have the smarts and the dedicated professionals to be able to do safe cesareans today.
Mm.
But that person with two transverse babies or a single transverse baby, 15 minutes later, could have a head down baby if they did a forward leaning inversion during a contraction.
Hmm.
And nobody knows that. I would love to have that studied. It happens in pregnancy, very easy, relatively easy. I would say, I'm going to say 19 out of 20 times that the forward leaning inversion done in a particular program, and I'm coming out with an ebook called When the Baby Lies Sideways, and it should be out this month, or in June rather.
Mm-hmm.
And in June 2020. Mm-hmm. And for breech now, it's not as simple. It's not just one thing. Like for babies who are sideways, it's pretty much one thing that's holding them there, and that's a twist in the uterus. For breech, it might be a twist in the uterus. It might be a twist in the respiratory diaphragm. It might be tightness in the round ligaments. It might be six things. And we go through a program to try to address 80% of those things that usually are associated with having the baby stay in a breech position. Now, when you had a long Cushing stage with your first one, and contractions that were incoordinated, that's an indication. Incoordinated contractions are a symptom of a twist in the uterus.
Oh.
A baby flipping breech at the last minute is an indication of that twist is low.
Mm.
So the baby is just like, I can't have my head here. Not that their head is that big, but compared to their skinny little butt, yes.
Hmm.
Now, when a baby is breech, they can still fit the uterus. It's the head of the obstetrician that doesn't fit. It's that fact, and what I mean by that is we've given up our breech skills around the world, except for a very active small group of breech experts. In Australia, there's Andrew Bissetts. Andrew Bissetts is going to talk at the Spinning Babies 2020 World Confluence about the rights of the breech baby in this October 2020. And we have breech experts in Germany, Frank Leuven, Anke Reiter. In the UK, Sean Walker, Jane Evans, in Ottawa with Betty Ann Davis, there are breech experts that are holding the understanding of how the breech rotates through the pelvis and how to help the baby be flexed, even if it's at the last minute to rotate and flex the baby for any time the arms or head are stuck. There's other complications of breech birth, but in a situation where the baby is discovered to be breech and pushing, it's typically, if the baby's healthy and doing well, the heart rate's well, then it's a matter of rotation or flexion to make sure that the baby's born safely. And with those skills in the hands of the midwife or obstetrician. Mm-hmm. Now, Frank Luhmann's proven that vaginal birth is safer than a cesarean when there's a hands and knees position for the person giving birth, and that person knows how to identify how the baby should look for normal breech birth and how to rotate the baby's shoulders by the chest if the shoulders are stuck, and how to bring the arms down, and then how to tuck that little face. There's like 6-7 ways to tuck the chin to the chest if the head is remaining inside. Mm-hmm. Everybody's freaking out about that. The techniques are simple. We can learn them, but it's a cultural aversion to breech birth that's caused all breeches to be born by cesarean. And it's a crime against humanity. It's an insult to that little breechling. It can be the safest birth. If the baby's not coming, then it's the safest birth, you know. But once the baby's butt is born, the rest of the baby will fit. And then it's a matter of skills. If you don't have the skills available, if the doctor or midwife have no idea what they're doing, it's safer to have a cesarean.
Hmm. Yeah.
The baby is likely to be born safely, but if the case that they're not, it's terrible. But if they have the skills, Andrew Bissett's going to teach this October in Australia at our conference, then, you know, I want to bring those skills back because people have a right to be born.
Yeah, we really need those skills to come back, because we used to rely on that for up until only, 100 years ago.
Not even 100 years ago. In 1970, there was a 5% cesarean rate in the United States of America.
Whoa.
Then some doctors got together and said, let's do cesareans for the breeches. And the cesarean rate soared. And now we have doctors saying, let's do cesareans for posterior babies. And mothers are writing me and saying, do I have to have a cesarean because my baby's sunny side up? Where any doctor proposing that, you know, 30 years ago would have been laughed out of the room, or they would have been gasped at knowing that they were in it for the money.
Yeah.
It's a lack of skills. I mean, posterior babies can have trouble getting born sometimes. But if we understand the physiology and we understand how to help parents either help the baby turn so it's no longer posterior, or help make room so the posterior baby can be born, or know to do a cesarean at the right time. Those are our three options.
Yeah. Gail, I will put links in the show notes to the Spinning Babies website and of course, your Facebook page. Is there anywhere else you'd recommend people going to learn more about what we've discussed today or to get in contact with you?
Yeah, I mean, our spinningbabies.com website is really the best place to come. I would also say if pregnant parents are interested in working with someone who's trained and approved by Spinning Babies to help them through their pregnancy, we have Spinning Babies certified parent educators who are listed on our website under the parent tab. Find a parent educator. You can register in their classes, get a video downloaded on how to do the techniques and why they work, and then have a one-to-one session or a small group session online. It's an online guided Spinning Babies parent class. And we have parent educators in Australia, New Zealand, in Europe, and in North America, and in Brazil. I think we just got a new one in possibly Venezuela. So 23 countries around the world, we have parent educators. And we connect now online because of the situation the world's in.
Yeah. What's happening with this conference in October?
Well, we are meeting right now. We are sorting through and meeting companies that are going to bring our conference virtual. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a protected local gathering in Caloundra on the Sunshine Coast. So Australians and probably New Zealanders mm-hmm. can gather there. Cool. It won't, it's not likely that there'll be international travel there.
No.
We'll still have our gathering of Australian experts, and we will have hands-on teaching with proper protective gear. We're going to do, my dream is a 24-hour coverage. We're going to gather in Minneapolis as well. And so that when Minneapolis has live coverage here, then we go to Australia for live coverage there. Then we have 24-hour coverage of the Spinning Babies paradigm with experts. And, you know, it's going to be fantastic. We are about to have registration in June of 2020. Mm-hmm. And we are having, there is continuing to be a special course after the conference that we call Aware Practitioner. And people learn techniques, body workers. It's specifically geared towards people who are doing body work with pregnant people in order to help their baby's position. So chiropractors, osteopaths, orthobiontomists, therapeutic massage therapists who have taken a spinning babies and they understand the gists of the spinning babies paradigm, then they can take this course for 4 days and then become an aware practitioner. We list our aware practitioners mm-hmm. and they're, we do have some in Australia and list them on our website so that people can find someone that knows how to work through our paradigm and on body work. And then as well as the parent educators, we do provider workshops. We're adapting our provider workshops that will now be online. And then we also have some online and in person with protective gear when little gatherings, a little bit more gatherings are appropriate and safe again. So we're shifting our services here to meet the demand. We've got a great, really great team around the world to bring this information to both parents and providers.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all the work that you do. I'm so glad that you're continuing to strive to spread the word, really.
Emily, thank you so much. And thank you for the work you do, because you also are a word spreader with your podcast. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, I was so pleased when you responded so eagerly at being interviewed for the podcast, and I've relished your passion in our conversation. So, yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
You're so welcome, Emily. Do you have anything else you want to finish with?
The final question I have for you to end on, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
The most important thing is love. It's that loving connection, and it's our safe physiology that helps us feel love in our body. And that's why body balancing is so important.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.